All right, officially, good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Intellectually, today we move into the Age of Enlightenment, the 18th century. Otherworldliness, and specifically religion, is down, substantially down in a good sense. It's on the defensive. Skepticism, the kind of skepticism we saw in Shakespeare in the Renaissance, is down. Reason is up. There's been a century preparing the ground for the takeoff of reason, and now it has finally reached its climax in the West. Politically, therefore, as you would have to expect, it's a revolutionary age, because when reason is up, freedom is up. And thus, the American Revolution in 1776, culminating in 1787, was the Constitution. And that happened to be the very same year as Don Carlos premiered. The French Revolution is only 2 years away in 1789. So we're in a great era of human thought and human freedom. We're in a way at the climax of the West, because it's downhill, intellectually speaking, from here. Now, Germany, you know, is one of the most philosophical countries, for good or evil, in all of Western history. And Friedrich Schiller is the best representative of the German Enlightenment. He's more philosophical than Goethe, and intellectually he's, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, he would be a half a point higher than Kant. Wherever you put the 1, he's a half a point higher. Schiller did not live very long. He died in his 40s. He was born in 1759, died in 1805. So almost all of his works are youthful. And he started Don Carlos when he was 23, which happens to be the same age that the real Don Carlos died. That was some 200 years earlier, in 1568. So it took Schiller 4 years to write this play, or to complete it. He started it in 1783, and he completed it 4 years later in 1787. And that's going to be relevant to understanding the play shortly. His great compatriot in literature was, you know, Abbot Costello, Schiller and Ham and Eggs, Schiller and Goethe. These are the two great German playwrights and poets of the German Enlightenment. And they happened to be friends and professional allies in the theater of Weimar in the last decade of Schiller's life. And later, after the World War I, when the Germans, the democratic Germans, wanted consciously to start a new regime, having overthrown the Kaisers, and to base it on true freedom, they called it the Weimar Republic, because that their motto was back to Schiller and Goethe. This was the truly exalted, freedom-loving era of Germany. Now, unfortunately, you know from having read my book, The Ominous Parallels, what happened to the Weimar Republic. And if I didn't explain it to you fully, you'll see even a bit more fully, having analyzed Schiller, who was the best thinker in the history of Germany, why the Weimar Republic went the way it did. That's a little negative as a starting note, so I want to start on a positive note. I want to quote from a Schiller scholar, Charles Passage, who gives the following very accurate factual evaluation of Schiller's importance. This is not a blurb, this is a historical truth. Schiller is the greatest writer of serious drama between the death of Racine in 1699 and the emergence of Ibsen as a master of the European theater around 1880. So he is the top writer of serious drama in a 200-year period. And then the quote goes on. This statement regards the intrinsic merit of Schiller's plays, their immense and extended popularity and performance, and their influence on subsequent dramatic and non-dramatic writers. Now, if you want a capsule cultural commentary on the state of life and of thought in America today, I'll simply point out to you that you cannot find Schiller in bookstores in Southern California. It's just simply unavailable. You have to go to libraries or specialized reading shops in New York. I don't know San Francisco. But this to me is a horrifying sign of the emerging barbarism and the loss of great classics in an eloquent way. Now, that quote said how influential he was, and some of his followers, I'm sure you must have heard of. For instance, the opera composer Verdi was a follower of Schiller, and when he wrote Don Carlo, which was his version of this very play, he was taken tremendously by the Grand Inquisitor, which is fantastic in the play, as we'll see, and in Verdi. And who else? A famous Russian novelist, highly admired by Ayn Rand, who wrote a book which the outstanding sequence includes the Grand Inquisitor as Dostoevsky, and he was inspired directly by Schiller. So those are just a couple of the kind of giants that sprang from Schiller, and particularly from this play. Now, Schiller himself was a professor of history. All Germans are professors. And a writer of philosophy, especially in the field of aesthetics, beyond, of course, being a playwright and a poet. He had definite political ideas, but he was not an activist. He didn't believe that his social ideals could be achieved in that period of time. The establishment, he thought, was just too entrenched. And his goal was to bring about political action in the future through philosophical education now. He wanted a thorough reform of our political thought and life to be achieved basically through the education that he would put forth in his plays. Now, a preliminary word about the play as part of our introduction. Don Carlos is set in the 16th century, although it was written in the 18th. And it's allegedly the story of Don Carlos, the son of Philip II of Spain, who was a powerful, absolute monarch, and he ruled much more than Spain. Now, I indicated to you that the real Don Carlos died in 1568, and as far as I can make out, the real Don Carlos was a very unappetizing creature. He was a half-wit, a sadist, ugly, a womanizer, mentally unbalanced, and in despair of what to do with him, his father locked him up and just made him stay in a room in which he alternately starved himself to death and then gorged himself. So he was kind of like the father of bulimia. And then died. In the Protestant world, which was politically and religiously opposed to Catholic Philip and to Spain, a myth arose of Don Carlos' heroism and of the vicious king who killed him. And this myth was gradually elaborated in detail and was summed up in a widely believed story about Don Carlos, which was allegedly the full truth about him, written by one Abbé de Saint-Réal. Now, Saint-Réal's story was Schiller's point of departure. He believed that it was historically accurate. Now, I want to plunge right in with the analysis of the plot theme, because as I've told you, this is an extraordinarily long play, as long as any two Shakespearean plays put together, which Schiller himself concedes a problem with the play. Let's look now at number two, the plot theme. Well, here's a standard description that you get among commentators. See what you think of this. A tragedy of hopeless love. Would that you could do the plot theme of this play in five words. A tragedy of hopeless love. Now, obviously, that is completely inadequate. There is an element of that, I suppose, between Don Carlos and the Queen, but that idea of hopeless love goes all the way through literature. It's in Othello, for instance. It's in Wuthering Heights. It's in Gone with the Wind. So we have to do an awful lot to turn A Tragedy of Hopeless Love into Don Carlos. Now, the first thing we obviously have to do is add a political element to our statement, because there is a fight for liberty against an absolute monarch. Now, you may be tempted to say, well, that's just background for the love story, or that's just really the abstract intellectual theme. But I would say to you, no, this fight for liberty actually motivates much of the action. It is a literal part of the explicit motivation of the leading characters. So it is not simply a background or a side message. It's part of the actual story. In a way, it is the actual story. And therefore, the test here is, does it motivate their action, or did they just talk about it in the drawing room? And here it motivates their action, so it can't be omitted from the plot theme. Well, how about then saying a story of tragic lovers engulfed in a passionate struggle for liberty? Or more briefly, doomed love in a dictatorship, with the lovers doomed because they're trying to challenge or overthrow the ruler. No, that's no good. As a statement of the plot theme, we the living is exactly doomed love in a dictatorship. 1984 by George Orwell is the same. Even Antigone, you could say, is doomed love in a dictatorship. Now, in We the Living in 1984 and others like it, however, there is this difference. The lover's primary goal is their love. They fight the dictatorship as a means to this goal. In other words, they want to escape from servility so as to be able to enjoy and fulfill their love. And so they go on loving each other romantically, sleeping together, until one or both are destroyed physically or spiritually by the evil tyrant. Now in Don Carlos, by contrast, the love affair, well, I can't say love affair because they never sleep with each other. The love relationship between Don Carlos and the Queen is not the primary concern of any character, including Don Carlos and the Queen. In fact, the characters all say that it is an obstacle to what they want. And therefore, they renounce their love virtually from the start, and then again officially later. It's an obstacle to their higher value, which is, well, it sounds funny to say the liberty of the Netherlands, but we're going to call that world liberty, because Netherlands, or in other contexts, Flanders, which is equivalent to Belgium today, was the center of the Protestant world. And so that meant if they were free, the whole rest of the Protestant world would be free, and it would then theoretically overturn the Catholic world. So it comes down to that their higher value, their highest value, is really world liberty. Now note that it is not Philip, the king, who ends their love. The Queen and Don Carlos end it as an act of virtue, of nobler consciousness, of deliberate commitment to world freedom, and they renounce their love before they slept together once. So if the essential of this play were a love story, it would be a disaster as a play. It would be a love story without love, or with only platonic love, which is even worse. Now, of course, the love story does somehow fit into the plot theme, but still deeper is the fight for world freedom against a tyrannical king. So where are we now? We can't stop with just that generalized statement. Let us try to approach it from the point of view of the protagonist. Who is fighting this king? Who is the chief initiator of the action? the chief hero, the chief emotional focus of the play. Now, obviously, it's not the queen. I won't even bother giving you reasons why. And it's obviously not the king because he's against freedom or his court. So the two real leaders, the two candidates, have to come out to be Don Carlos and Poza, his friend. Well, I can't say his friend, as you'll see later. That's a very important point. But his associate. Well, is there then a joint equal battle among equal partners between these two, or is one of them dominant in the fight for liberty over the other? Well, as you read the play at the beginning, it seems pretty clear that the protagonist is... No, as you read it at the very beginning, Don Carlos, the play is called Don Carlos. For over two acts, the story revolves around his passion to unite with the queen and his fear that the king is going to find out, and the king's jealousy of those, and it's Don Carlos who has to be leader of the army in Flanders. And all this time, Poza, I'm going to call him Poza, not Roderick, because that's what he's called. Poza, in action, is merely his friend, his confidant, even his gopher, delivering notes, albeit with some strong speeches. But then you think over the first half a little more deeply. Who is it who convinces Don Carlos and the Queen to forget their love life in order to fight for mankind's freedom? Poza. Don Carlos and the Queen are sunk into passive misery until he comes along and awakens their ideals. So he is the real, even if only implicit, mover of the action in the first half. And then in the second half of the play, his role becomes blatant. He openly, Poza, takes over the play and the political action. He's the one who beseeches the king to reform. He becomes the king's agent. He plots each step of the future, leaving Don Carlos at certain points completely baffled, a mere reactor. And then Poza even sets up his own death and its aftermath. In other words, Poza becomes the actor, the initiator, the protagonist. Now, what are we going to make with this? Is Don Carlos a red herring? Well, before we pronounce on that, to get the plot theme of this play is half of the trouble. Before we get to make a final decision here, I want you to observe another new element in the second half of the play. Not only the ascendancy of Poza to the position of protagonist, the second half of the play features a new love triangle. A second love triangle. The emphasis is no longer on Don Carlos, the queen, the king, although there are still scenes about the king's jealousy in regard to the queen. But from early Act 3 on, from precisely the point where the king says what four words? Anybody? Give me a man. That is to say, a man I can count on. There is a major shift in the love story. The king grows to love Poza as the focus of the story. And the queen drops into the background. The king makes Poza his spy. And Don Carlos begins to suspect Poza of betraying him to the king. Remember his portfolio that he gave? Somebody else sees Poza giving it to the king. And Don Carlos begins to agonize jealously over his lost... Are we having a problem?
Yeah, I'm going to pump that mic. Is it okay if I just put up this other
one? Yes.
Thank you.
I can still breathe with this mic.
Yeah.
Don Carlos begins to agonize jealously over his lost love, namely Poza. And then Poza tells Don Carlos that he really loved him all the time. The king was merely a tool of his plan. And then the king discovers this truth and is insanely jealous, crushed. So in other words, the play stresses the rivalry. Is this getting too loud now? No? The same? Because now I can hear it. The play stresses the rivalry between the king and Don Carlos for Poza. And when the king realizes that he's lost Poza, he goes after Don Carlos's life as revenge, as vengeance because of Poza's love betrayal of him. Now, by this point, the king's jealousy of the queen has basically vanished. The queen had confronted him earlier, cleared the air, and that was the end of that story. In other words, the final outcome of the play is related to the second triangle, not to the first. Now, I'd like to look at this second triangle for a moment because we have to have some understanding in order to be able to even state the plot theme. As this triangle sneaks up on you, and it is not exactly your most conventional love triangle. Now, one intelligent Schiller scholar, I'll give you a few excerpts, puts it this way. Carlos's denunciation of the king in the presence of Poza's corpse is the frenzied taunting of a rival in love. Similarly, the king's monstrous behavior afterwards, after he finds out the truth, betokens a subconscious erotic jealousy and a ghastly rage over betrayal in love. I'm still continuing from the commentator. Nowhere does the text suggest any fleshly expression of passion on the part of any of the three male personages in question. Yet in 1788, that's the year after Don Carlos, Schiller began planning a drama in which three figures predominated, a father, a son, and the son's friend, with an exalted male passion explicit between the son and his friend, unquote. So what do you make of that? Is this homosexuality? We have a play about gay relationships in 18th century classic German literature? Well, a very contorted question. I don't think so. But I do believe that it is still love that is being portrayed here. In other words, Schiller intends something more than strong, warm, close friendship. He does want to depict real male love in some romantic sense, even though he does not believe that that entails sex or even sexual desire. Does that baffle you? How many find that baffling? How many find that incompatible with objectivism? I didn't get many takers there. Well, I want to read you a quote from Ayn Rand now. This is from an unpublished letter of hers in 1944. It's written about the Fountainhead with, of course, no thought at all for Don Carlos as she was writing this letter. It's to a fan. And I'll just read a little self-contained excerpt, which you will either consider as self-evident or as a revelation. You ask, Miss Rand, I'm quoting from her letter, you ask, is anybody in the Fountainhead in love besides Rourke and Dominique? Oh my, yes. Then she goes on to talk about Rourke and Dominique, Wynand and Dominique, and then she writes these words, which I'll quote without any comment right now. Quote, but above all, this is in the context of Rourke and Dominique and Wynand and Dominique. Quote, but above all, and greater, I think, than any other emotion in the book, is Wynand's love for Rourke. Wynand is in love with Rourke. In every way except physical. It is not a homosexual feeling, but it is love in the romantic sense and in the highest sense, not just affection or admiration. Unquote. Now, this is exactly what Schiller had in mind. Now, I'd like you to ponder this so you won't be too scandalized by Schiller here. He holds, and obviously Ayn Rand agrees with him, that a passionate, even romantic, male relationship is possible between heroes, even between objectivist heroes. So that you have to be sure you know what you object to if and when you attack gay, lib, or male lovers. But that is another subject. I'd be happy to comment on that in the question period if you feel that it's not all self-evident. But for now, I want to go back to Schiller with simply that intriguing note. So we're still plodding along trying to get the plot theme here. I go back to the protagonist. It's pretty clear that who is the protagonist? Posa. But why is it so difficult to find out? Well, it took him 4 years to write this play, as I said. And he underwent real personal changes while writing it. He started at 23 and he finished it at 27, which is a very, very fertile period in an intelligent person's life. They undergo great changes in their from early to late 20s. What happens is that he basically outgrew the character of Don Carlos, with whom he could identify at the beginning, and came to admire Posa, a much more philosophical and long-range character, as the hero. Now, one accidental factor was that in the middle of the writing, after he's half finished, he discovered that Saint-Réal's story about Don Carlos was a total invention, and that therefore the biography on which he was allegedly basing the play was just wrong. And that helped him further to lose interest in Don Carlos, the character, as a primary focus. So he wrote the last two acts with Posa as his protagonist. And just enough skillful continuity. Every once in a while he'd ring the changes on the king and the queen and Don Carlos. Just enough continuity so it wasn't blatantly a different play. Now, you obviously want to ask, why didn't he rewrite Acts 1 to 3 accordingly from the point of view of his new and more mature perspective? Unfortunately, something stopped him from doing it. The first three acts had already been published, one act at a time in magazine form. So, as he saw it, the choice is abort the play or skillfully weave a new second half onto the first half. And that's what he tried to do. Now, from Act 4 on, it's basically Posa's story and the story of the second triangle, with the first triangle thrown in only occasionally for continuity. And by Act 5, the best act in the play, the first triangle is simply dead as a dramatic issue. All the key actions flow from the second triangle. Now, Schiller himself drew a moral from this crisis in his play's creation. He put it very aptly. He said, a play should be written in one summer. I spent too long on it. And God knows that is true. And that's the big flaw in the play. He just couldn't stop. And then he changed it in the middle and had a great play in the second half, but he had to tie it on to the first half. Now, the change comes exactly, and all Schiller scholars know this, at line 2,940. So you can just draw a line, and that's where the play effectively starts. When the king says, give me a man. So judging now from the total work, I think you have to say Posa is the protagonist even from the start. He supplies the play's ruling motive. And the first love story is basically only an obstacle to Posa's ideals. Posa wants Don Carlos as the legal successor to Philip to drop the queen, not risk a breach with Philip, and devote himself to the fight for liberty. And the love story about the queen is therefore really a relationship to be used by the playwright and then thrown away for the sake of the ultimate concerns of the story. So here are the elements of the plot theme, the longest we're going to have. You know, plot theme is like a definition. The briefer, the more essentialized, the better. But in this play, it's a paragraph. Now, I'll dictate it to you in a minute, but these are the main elements. A man fights for freedom, and it has to be world freedom, because this has got the stature of a great romantic play. The Secession of Staten Island wouldn't qualify. He fights against a tyrant who loves him. And we've got to make the point that the tyrant's in love with him, because that'll bring us in the second triangle. And he does it by backing the king's son as the next ruler in the succession. But it so happens that the son is in love with his father's new queen. And all these elements are important to the play. And therefore, we have a very complicated plot theme, really, because of the length and because of Schiller's change of mind during the writing. So the play has a real flaw, which is that it's just too convoluted for a play. I mean, for anything. But, I mean, this is the price you pay of genius, because if he had stayed on the level of the first three acts, I would never have assigned this play. Act four, and particularly act five, are what make this a unique masterpiece. Here then, though, for your notes, is the official statement of the plot theme of the total play as I now see it. I got it into three lines of type by the judicious use of punctuation. A man fights for world freedom. Against a tyrannical king who loves him, comma. By backing the king's son and heir, colon. A prince passionately in love with his father's new queen. Now that is a mouthful. And for a plot theme, it has virtue only in relation to the mammoth size of the play. But for an ordinary play, this wouldn't fulfill the function of a plot theme because it's just too much in it. But in this play, it's not a synopsis. This is just the situation. So I'll give it to you one more time. A man fights for world freedom against a tyrannical king who loves him by backing the king's son and heir. A prince passionately in love with his father's new queen. Now, this formulation permits you to enter the essence of the play. All the major motivations, personal and political, are implied in it, and above all the crucial conflicts. What is the major conflict? The first question we always ask after the plot theme is the defining conflict of the play. And from the plot theme statement, you should be able to read it off. What is the decisive conflict? Posa versus the king. Posa versus the king. But of course, as in all great plays, variants of this conflict, rage or derivatives, aspects of it throughout the work. There's Posa versus Don Carlos over the ultimate goal to pursue. And the king versus Don Carlos over the queen. And then the king and Don Carlos over Posa. And of course over freedom. And of course king versus Posa when we get to the second triangle. And even Don Carlos versus Posa over the king. And there's just a tumult of violent conflicts, which is a great virtue of Schiller. He specialized in plot themes with multiple passionate inbuilt conflicts. And therefore, he could write passionate, highly exciting, dramatic plays. Now, one final note here as we leave the plot theme. I have omitted Princess Eboli from our discussion. And the reason is, I do not regard her as an essential of the play. She is a side issue, a subplot only, even though she takes up a lot of space in the first triangle. But she's in effect a go-between relating other truly major characters. So thankfully, we can drop her as of now. We already have a huge plateful to deal with without her. Now let's look at number three, plot development. Now, if you understand the plot theme, the development is very straightforward. All of the seven plays I've chosen have an exquisitely logical development, because if they didn't, I wouldn't choose them. So they're all perfect in structure, absolutely logical. And here is the three parts of the plot development of the Schiller. Number one, the establishment of the situation. Now, in this play, it consumes a lot of space because of the change of triangles. The second triangle must be established before you really have the situation and can then rise to intensity. So in my opinion, the establishment includes all of Acts 1 and 2, and Act 3 through Scene 9. By the way, according to the, whether you get an American or a continental numbering, the number of the scenes differs from edition to edition. So I can't just say Scenes 1 to 9, because in different editions, it's broken up differently. But it's Scene 1 to 9 in the edition I assigned. That's what you need to get the essence of Triangle 1 and its complications, and then get Triangle 2 started. It basically, the establishment is over when we get to I need a man, send me Posa. That gets the ultimate play going. And then comes number 2, the rise to the climax. And that goes from Act 3, Scene 10, through Act 5, Scene 3, which is the death of Posa. In other words, all of the milking of the Posa triangle. Posa's fight for world freedom against the king. His plea to the king to, you know, reform and give us a new age. And then Posa's takeover. I'm not going to summarize it all, but you know the rising events here. Posa's takeover and arrest of Don Carlos to save him, all the way until Posa's final recognition that there's no way out except through his own self-sacrifice. If he's to save the heir to the throne, it has to be him that's going to go instead of Don Carlos. So finally, he tells the whole story to Don Carlos. And as he's talking, there's a shot through the door. And Posa says, he's very quick, this king, haltingly. He's dying. I hoped for more. Consider your escape. You hear? Consider your escape. The queen knows everything. I can no more. Dies. The king enters with his court. Now that is the climax of the play, in my judgment. The death of Posa. I'll give you a slightly different definition of climax now. It occurred to me that you can define climax in epistemological or metaphysical terms. And so far I've been using an epistemological definition, that event from which you can tell how the ultimate resolution is going to come. But a more metaphysical definition seems more clarifying for this play, and I would, therefore, I think it's, they come to the same thing. But this is perhaps even a better definition of climax. The event which directly, although not necessarily immediately, dictates the final outcome. The event which directly, although not necessarily immediately, dictates the final outcome. Now, in a good play, every event implies the outcome, but it does it through all the intermediate events. The climax is the event in which you can say the next causal step is the outcome. But it doesn't happen immediately. It can take a long time, and that causal step can be presented in a lot of sub-steps. Now, you see, that's basically the same idea of a climax, only instead of saying the event from which you can figure out, it really goes a little deeper. You can figure out from the climax, because that's the event itself which leads to the ultimate resolution. And I find that in some plays the epistemological formulation is more helpful, and in others, such as this one, which is so convoluted, you can't quite figure out from anything what's coming next. But when you look back on it, you see that this is the event on which it all turned. Now, let me explain why I call this the climax. Does Poza's death actually determine the final outcome of the play? And I say yes, because once Poza has died, a tragic ending is necessary. Why? Because Poza is the protagonist, the mainspring of the action. After he dies, that mainspring is broken. Don Carlos can only react to the loss. Now, of course, in theory, Don Carlos could escape and carry on Poza's work. But then, so could Kira and We the Living have escaped. But in both cases, it would have been simply accident. If we go by the essence of the situation and the characters, Don Carlos was never a prime mover. His energy was Poza's energy. And without Poza, we could not expect him to determine events. Similarly, the king's only redeeming features were brought out by Poza's love, or seeming love, for him. And when Poza is gone, the king turns into a monster. So the situation is that when Poza dies, Don Carlos is prostrate with grief. The king turns vindictive, and the writing is on the wall. The destruction of the good forces is inevitable. Now, I want to pursue this issue of climax for a moment here, because this is our section on the logic of the play. That's what the development covers. And I'd like to ask you, why did Schiller have Poza die? Maybe you see with me that if Poza, and once Poza dies, that foretokens tragedy. But why did Poza have to die? Why did he have to fail in his quest? Wouldn't this play be fine, all the same, but with a happy ending? Both Poza and Don Carlos escape, riding off side by side into the sunset for Flanders, leaving the king behind to gnash his teeth. And I would say, no, then you are not talking about the same play at all, then. Because what would the meaning of that play be? It would remember, you judge meaning by action. You don't not judge it by speeches, unless those speeches are integral to the action. And if they could ride off into the sunset and save Flanders, the meaning would be tyranny and the Inquisition are not so powerful. They're not so terrible. All you need is a little commitment, and the whole free world out there will rise up and welcome you. And if that were the situation, why the heavens didn't Poza and Don Carlos ride out in Act One instead of staying in Spain and arguing with Philip with all the complications and that involved? Remember, the heart of Poza's plan, which is to back Don Carlos as the heir, the successor for the future, the heart of that plan necessarily puts off success to the next generation, at least. Poza's mission in the play is not to establish freedom, but to fight within the system to convert Don Carlos. And he actually sends Don Carlos away only when things get desperate, and by then it's too late to win. And the reason for this is that Schiller wants to show in this play the kind of character necessary if a new era of freedom is ever to be developed. He wants to show the evolution. This is why he called the play Don Carlos, even with the new protagonist. He wants to show the evolution of Don Carlos from a passive, self-absorbed creature to the full, decisive maturity at the end. But Schiller, had no intention of showing that character in successful political action. He himself would say, and did say, he wrote a series of very famous letters about this play in answer to critics the year after he wrote the play. And the reason I picked this translation is that for the first time ever, these letters are all included at the back in English. So, of course, this edition went out of print as soon as I signed it. But in any event, in his letters, he says it's simply too soon in history to expect, you know, we're talking here about the 16th century, to expect that actual freedom could be established. Real world freedom is for a later era. I, he says, am simply showing you how someday the world is going to get there, and it's going to get there with the creation of characters, the education of characters like Don Carlos into the kind of hero who will then ascend to the throne and create a revolution. So the climax of this play, consonant with Schiller's strategy, with his intention, poses failure, at least in concrete terms. In other words, his inability to establish his political system, in other words, his defeat by the incumbent system, in other words, that means, dramatically speaking, his death. So this is an absolutely logical climax, inevitable by the structure of the play. And that leads us to, I put these in because I know a lot of you have the idea, oh, it would be such a much better play if it had a happy ending. You cannot throw a happy ending on a play unless the play requires it and builds up to it and can cash it in. A play like this with a happy ending tacked on would be an absurdity and would have no conviction and no reality. That's why you have to earn a happy ending. A happy ending is like becoming a billionaire. And it doesn't happen to you without blood, sweat, and tears. And every part of your structure, your characters, your plot, leading inexorably to that happy ending. Now we get to the resolution. This is, by the way, it just happens that since these terms are all French, this is commonly called the denouement. That's just a synonym for resolution. Now, in this play, in my judgment, the resolution is by far the greatest, the most exalted and magnificent part of the play. And it's the only reason I chose this play. If we had had to go through the first three acts only, I never would have chosen this play, although it has a lot of virtues, but it's just a good romantic play up to there with some confusions and typically Germanic and overlong. But from scene four of act four to the very ending, from scene four of act five to the very ending, which is the bulk of act five, you have an unprecedented dramatic spectacle. Ray Cole was saying at one point, he's told me, he cursed me while he was reading this play. Why did I make him go through these hundreds of pages? But he had to agree with me that when you get to Act 5, any price is worth it to be able to read and enjoy the last act of this play. Starting with Don Carlos taunting the king after Poza's death. Then the king's love of Poza turning before our eyes into pure hatred for humanity. With fabulous lines, like the king said, he, Poza, sacrificed me to humanity, humanity shall make atonement, unquote. Now they're going to get what's coming to them, the bloody race, you see. Soon, quickly, all the proofs of Don Carlos' disloyalty flood in, the letters of Poza are intercepted, and then comes the greatest... I make this as a flat statement. I don't even say it's my opinion. The greatest, most dramatic, most philosophical scene in all world theatrical literature. And that is the Grand Inquisitor scene. The Grand Inquisitor called in by the king for guidance as to what the king should do about Don Carlos. Now that Poe is dead, but Don Carlos is still plotting rebellion. And he wants guidance, and boy, does the Grand Inquisitor give him guidance. And we'll go over that in some detail shortly. And then, directly after that, Don Carlos's fate, a powerful staccato burst. Don Carlos is flushed with excitement over his plans. He's finally going to take off for Flanders and lead the crusade. He's going to come out into the open, finally. And as a symbol of this, he's going to take off his mask. He's been hiding his identity from the Queen's guards. And he says to the Queen, "My wish is that there should be nothing more between us which is secret. Let this be my last deceit." He starts to take off his mask. The King had entered unseen, steps up to him and declares, "It is your last." Queen faints. Don Carlos, "Oh heaven, oh earth, then is she dead?" King, coldly and quietly to the Grand Inquisitor, "Now I have done my part. See you do yours." Curtain. Now that is a finale. I couldn't restrain myself when I read that. I wrote in the margin, "Like a knife in the chest." The most powerful ending. Now, the Grand Inquisitor scene I'm saving to discuss under Schiller's philosophy, but it's that scene in conjunction with the immediately following arrest of Don Carlos, which is what is so fantastic about this play. Let's make a start on characters. Number four, before we take our break. How many major characters? Well, we have a long plot theme, so we have to say there's four major characters. The Queen, Don Carlos, the King, Poza. Those are all in the plot theme. Now, the Queen does not have to hold us for long. A relatively weak character. She initiates no action. Sweet, gentle, passive, more or less like Desdemona. Certainly much lesser creature than Antigone or Chimene. The least important of the major characters and pretty much dropped by the time the play really gets started. Goodbye, Queen. Now, Don Carlos. What is his essential character trait as presented in the play? Is he a crusader? Is he primarily an idealist? No, using objectivist terms, which is not Schiller's, but nevertheless, he is primarily a what? No, I'm thinking of a different aspect. He's not so much secondhand. He doesn't have a lot of ideas. But in terms of the way he functions, he is an emotionalist, a whim worshiper, if you wish, until the very last scene. He has a lot of qualities like the villains in Atlas Shrugged. He suffers a lot, but he doesn't do very much about it. He is a man of feeling, passive, sensitive, even helpless apart from Poza. He walks around asking everybody to love him. He wants Poza, the Queen, even the King. He says, "Just don't hate me and I'll love you like a child." And that's pretty much true. There are constant eruptions of sudden passion on his part where he drops all context and jeopardizes his plans. For instance, at one point, he breaks out into a fit and antagonizes Alba until the Queen has to command him to come to his senses. And at another point, remember, he gets deliriously happy when the secret note comes from Eboli. He thinks it's from the Queen, and the page has to tell him to shut up. So he is, in effect, a reckless emotionalist. And apart from Poza, his life is empty, melancholy, inactive, and he's getting pretty bitter, too. He does have good attributes. He's shown to be intelligent and brave. For instance, he did take the punishment for Poza when they were both children. He's idealistic, and he's capable of being converted to a passion for world freedom. But he desperately needs the conversion. He needs to grow to become steady, mature, strong, long range. He needs to develop his virtues and correct his flaws. And that was Schiller's intention, to show, in effect, a playboy become a hero. Not a playboy in the gross sense of sleeping around, but what we would call a whim worshiper. Now, what is the main flaw he needs to learn to correct, according to Schiller? What is the main weakness of Don Carlos that Poza struggles to put down in him, in a single word, with an S? Selfishness. The desire for personal romantic happiness. And what does he have to learn? He has to learn to place his passion at the service of the world. That's a theme we're going to return to shortly. And now let's turn to the king. And then we'll take a break because Poza is a long story to analyze. The king is a mixed character, evil but with an idealistic side, an interesting character. He falls somewhere between the Grand Inquisitor at one extreme and Poza at the other. He is jealous, weak, melancholy, and with a real potential to become vicious. And on the other hand, he's intelligent. He has a quality of aspiration, and he's even capable of being large-hearted and magnanimous. For instance, he forgives the Spanish Armada for his disastrous loss. And it's good of the part of the playwright to throw in a few concretes like that so we can really get a feel for these characters. The king, like any mixed character, is a hotbed of contradictions character-wise. He is animated by power lust and at the same time really admires Poza's independence. He sneers at the human race and at the same time he feels painfully alone. He needs a friend, a man to love and communicate with. He sneers at emotion. He considers it unmanly and weak. And on the other hand, he needs love authentically, and he cries when he doesn't get it. So he is a contradictory, malleable man. He is the true gray man, or if you want, he's the mixed economy of the spirit. So he can be shaped temporarily, at least by a better influence. But at the end and at bottom, he is going to have to become a tool of evil. Because any so-called mixed economy, as you know, if it's not radically cured, will turn inevitably black and disastrous. And that's just what happens to the king. And in the last act, we actually witness his love for Poza turn to hate, and then we see his willing conversion into a puppet of the Grand Inquisitor. And that brings us to Poza, the real hero on whose character the whole interpretation of the play depends. And here I will give you a 6-minute break starting now. In regard to the character of Poza, with the central fact that we've already seen about him, he has to fail. Now, so far, we've looked at this issue externally. In other words, given the playwright's viewpoint, Poza has to die, given the structure of the play. But that leaves open a crucial question. What within Poza himself causes his failure? What makes it believable, understandable, inevitable? What is the inner logic of his failure and death? Is Poza just a helpless victim of evil, or does he contribute to his own downfall? This is the play, the question that takes you into the heart of the message of Don Carlos and the philosophy of Schiller. Well, first of all, Schiller writes about this extensively in the play itself and in the 12 famous letters that are appended at the back. No, he says, Poza is not just a helpless victim of evil. Poza has an Achilles heel. He's defeated by something within himself, something in the very nature of his character, something good, something in the nature of his virtue brings about his downfall, according to Schiller. Now, what could it be? Well, let's say some positive things about Poza first. What good traits does he have? He's long range, purposeful, passionate. He's resourceful, daring, eloquent, grown up in contrast to Don Carlos, although they're the same age. Very philosophical. And what is the essence now of his motivation in Qua Hero? He is a crusader for mankind. His primary value is dedication to the well-being, the freedom of... How many of you know German philosophy? Guess what word? Freedom of the... of the whole. W-H. And his decisive action that he takes is... sacrifices himself, not for his friend, not for Don Carlos, but for the ultimate sake of fostering the course of world freedom. And in fact, you know, the Don Carlos legend had been done in theater and plays many, many times over the centuries. Schiller's own idea, for his first idea for his own version of this play, the first thing that occurred to Schiller and then made it of interest to him to write, he originated the idea that Poza will rescue Don Carlos by an act of self-sacrifice. And thereby, you see, in Schiller's mind, Poza will inspire Don Carlos to emulate him and also to sacrifice, become a lover of the world, grow up, sacrifice his private cares, and live for mankind as a whole. So the play, the genesis of the play historically in Schiller's mind was his unique twist would be to have Poza sacrifice himself. Now, this certainly suggests that Poza is the opposite of an egoist. And that is something that is all over the play. That he is an altruist, that his concern is the welfare of the world, that the evil is selfishness. Here, for instance, is the quote from the play. Poza is disappointed at this point. He sees Don Carlos pining away for the queen. He wants to know, what happened to your childhood idealism when we were both going to save the world? And he says, quote, all of that is gone, devoured by one emotion, the victim of one small and selfish interest. Your heart has ceased to beat. There are no tears left over for the wretched fortune of the province. Not one small tear is left. Oh, Carlos, you are desperately poor since you love no one but yourself. And this goes on and on over and over in the play. Now let's go a bit deeper into Schiller's thought on this subject. He's very anxious that Poza's motivation not be misunderstood, so he goes to great lengths in his letters to clarify exactly what moves Poza and why, by his essential nature, Poza had to fail, by the very nature of his virtue. And here are some highlights from Schiller's own analysis. I'm excerpting like 100 pages into two, but it'll give you the idea. First, he stresses that Poza is not primarily Don Carlos's friend. He's not anybody's friend, because friendship is not an important value to him. His concern, says Schiller, is not some one individual, but the whole. Now, this is the same country, you know, that gave us Hegel and Marx. Schiller is definitely German. In relation to the whole of mankind, says Schiller, quote, every limited, smaller condition vanishes. In other words, every individual vanishes. Poza's primary identity is not a friend of anyone, but a crusader, a revolutionary, a servant of mankind. And Don Carlos, therefore, is not a man he loves, but rather an indispensable tool for Poza's political ideals. In other words, the basis has been laid in the play for Poza to have a pretty cavalier attitude toward Don Carlos. A pretty damn cavalier attitude toward Don Carlos. Now, Schiller understands this and is very deliberate. Remember, whatever you think of his ideas, and I don't think much of his ideas, he is a philosopher playwright. He doesn't write for CBS. He knows what world love as a primary means. The hero must be willing to renounce and sacrifice any personal love on behalf of the whole. He has to, in other words, be indifferent, even callous, to the welfare and needs of any one individual, including his dearest, closest friend, if he thereby fosters the well-being of the species. In other words, he has to be a true exponent of German philosophy. Now, against this background, let us look at Poza's most controversial action in the play, on which the critics descended on Schiller, and on which the whole complication of the play depends, the whole last part. Question: why did Poza not tell Don Carlos right off the bat in Act 3 of his new relationship to the king? Why did he let the second triangle develop at all? Why did he keep Don Carlos in the dark about his real intentions? Leave him feeling suspicious, jealous. Why did he say nothing when a word for him would have brought Don Carlos into the light? He would have known what's going on. There would have been no misunderstanding. Don Carlos would never have had to rush to Eboli as his only friend left. And then there would have been no need to arrest Don Carlos to save him from himself. And then there would have been no need for Poza's sacrifice. In other words, the whole disaster would not have taken place. And Schiller himself is a very honest man. And when the critics put this question to him, he rewrote it in even stronger terms and then gave his answer. It's really fascinating to see someone answer rather than evade a major question, even though the answer is even worse. But here is Schiller himself saying, the reserve of Poza — now, a reserve means he's not telling anyone, including Don Carlos, about his plan — is the single source of all the subsequent confusion, unquote. And then he goes on. Listen to this, it's really well written. Many people have reproached Poza that he, who fosters such a high concept of freedom and is incessantly talking about it, should nevertheless assume a despotic option over his friend, that he should guide him blindly like someone underage, and precisely for that reason lead him to the brink of destruction. In other words, the critics got this massive contradiction. This freedom lover who's treating his friend as though he's dirt, it doesn't bother to enlighten him, and is just moving him around like a puppet. So why does Poza act like that? Is this inadvertence on Schiller's part? No, you can be sure in 4 years he figured it out. Obviously, his Achilles heel is at work. The inner defect which leads to his ruin and to a tragic ending for all the good characters. Something makes him secretive, even despotic, over other individuals, even his best friend. What could it be? Well, remember now, he has no friends. That's the key here. Only mankind as a whole is his concern. Individuals are a mere means to this end. So what do you expect? If that is his hierarchy of values, isn't it to be expected that he would treat everyone, including Don Carlos, as a puppet on strings to be pulled by him? In other words, that he would treat Don Carlos as a means or tool or even implicitly serf. Now, Schiller says it openly, and I'm going to give you some excerpts to show you how he himself puts the point in his letters. Now, his grammar is Germanic. There's nothing I can do about that. So they're long sentences, but try and get the meaning. Quote, "The most unselfish, purest, and noblest person, very often, because of enthusiastic devotion to his idea of virtue, very often is displayed dealing just as arbitrarily with individuals as even the most selfish despot." Did you get that? Now listen to this one. "True greatness of mind," in other words, 100% altruism, "true greatness of mind often leads no less to the violation of the freedom of others than does selfishness and the lust for power." Did you get that? "Even while a hero operates with constant regard to the whole, the smaller interest of the individual is only too easily lost in his broad perspective." And then he goes on a few lines later, I chose a totally benevolent character, completely above every selfish desire. I gave him the highest respect for the rights of others. I even gave him as a goal the creation of the universal enjoyment of freedom. And I believe I do not find myself in contradiction when I allow him on the way to that goal itself to stray into despotism. It was part of my plan that he should be caught in this trap that is set for all who find themselves on the same path with him." Unquote. Now I have to say, I fell out of my chair when I read that. If I ever heard propaganda for objectivism, that's it. In other words, let's just make the grammar a little simpler here in the language. Ignoring and sacrificing his friend, and doing it in effect heedlessly, even needlessly, is in the nature of his ideal, altruism, which makes him belittle any single person as just unimportant and not worth considering. Now, this is what leads to disaster. Does Schiller then, who is a philosopher, conclude there must be something wrong with altruism? It leads to destruction even when practiced by its purest exponents. Because that is exactly what his play demonstrates perfectly. It's like a textbook on the disaster of altruism. If Poza had thought of his private, selfish relationship to Don Carlos, of his special personal feeling for Don Carlos, then he would have felt this duty to Don Carlos to keep him informed. He wouldn't have treated him as a cog in a cosmic scheme. The disaster would never have occurred. Now, if I wrote that, my conclusion would be, geez, I got to switch my moral code completely then. I have to adopt egoism and start over. Now, what does Mr. Schiller conclude? The problem here, he says, is not a flaw in altruism. Not at all. This is simply a demonstration of how wonderful a code altruism is. It's a different problem, which we just simply can't escape. That's life. Guess what the problem is? Take a guess. No. We know the moral, but it just leads to disaster in practice. Moral versus the practical. The ideal versus the realistic. His very morality is going to necessitate practical disaster. And of course, you know that that's inherent in altruism anyway, so it's a good thing he held it.
The way Schiller puts it, you can guess whose influence this is. There is the theoretical reason, which gives us abstract theories of good and evil. And there is the practical reason, which gives us guidance directly from the heart. Did you ever hear that one before? Who said that? Immanuel Kant. So altruism, it stands in Schiller's mind like this. Altruism is the theoretical ideal. It motivates the hero in the play. The play's moral essence is the lesson that Don Carlos must learn to be a fit ruler, the lesson of service to mankind. And yet, the practice of that very ethics necessarily leads to disaster. And so Schiller concludes, theoretical ideals, rational ideals like altruism, can't be consistently practiced. In effect, all we can do in real life is act not by reason, but by our innate subjective feelings. Well, by now you must know the whole philosophy of Schiller, but that's certainly enough to give you some insight into Poza, so let us go to number 5, the theme of the play. Now, explicitly, what is the primary action concern of Poza, and thus the key value explicitly motivating him? In a word, freedom, world freedom. And so the first statement of the theme would be the value, the importance, the primacy of freedom. Now, of course, it's used in a generalized term, the word, but Schiller seems really to mean it. He gives freedom a content. It's not a bromide the way it is in the mouth of Stalin or Clinton or equivalent individuals. I didn't even mean that as humorous. But, to Schiller, freedom means freedom from arbitrary governmental authority. It means the right of the individual to live his life as he chooses. It means a republican form of government with the small r, as against tyranny, monarchy, and so on. In other words, he really does believe in political individualism and the rights of man. And there are major eloquent expressions of this in this play. For instance, in Act 3, Scene 11, when Poza first meets and beseeches the king to give his subjects liberty, there's a famous individualistic passage where he says, among many other similar things, he pleads with the king, "Then lead the way for Europe's kings. A single stroke done by your pen, and newly created is the earth. Give us the right to think with freedom." And note that formulation, to think with freedom. This is one of the earliest, most impassioned statements in Western dramatic literature, demanding the right of free thought. And it resonated long after Schiller died. As late as 1935, a German audience, under the rule of the Nazis, broke into spontaneous applause when this line was stated at Don Carlos. They were at the theater. And the next day, the Nazi paper formally rebuked them and reiterated the evil of freedom to think. Actually explicitly denounced this as a debased Jewish ideal. So Schiller was a rallying cry for liberty for a long, long time after his death. Now, so far, we haven't captured the full theme, because the primacy of freedom, yes, but over what? It's not so much directly over tyranny. What is the enemy or the obstacle to freedom as presented and dramatized in the play? What is Poza's virtue? What is it that makes him able to be a world fighter for freedom and not sunk in his own little romantic escapades? That he is a selfless crusader. What is the evil of Philip and the church and the Grand Inquisitor in terms of the play? They want power. For whom? Themselves. What is the lesson DC has? DC, that's what I wrote in my notes. I knew I would end up calling him DC. What is the lesson Don Carlos has to learn? Renunciation of personal love. So from every angle, the message is the primacy of freedom over selfishness. Now, if I can interject a comment as an objectivist, what a tragedy that this is his theme. The dichotomy of freedom versus selfishness. How can a man be free without a self? And if he is selfless, won't he then be docile to some authority eager to sacrifice him? But, of course, you know all this, so let us move on to abstract philosophy. Schiller's General Philosophy, point 6. Now, a philosophy, according to objectivism, has three central issues. And you know how Ayn Rand always summarized objectivism as reason, selfishness, capitalism, or freedom. And that is, in other words, epistemology, ethics, politics, with metaphysics being implied in epistemology. Well, what is Schiller's trinity? Freedom? Yes. Selfishness? No, the exact Kantian opposite. Well, what about the third issue, reason? Well, remember, we are in the Enlightenment. And the play gives you the explicit answer. Even aside from the Grand Inquisitor scene, there is what character? The religious priest, do you remember his name? Domingo? One of the villains, the enemy of Poza and of freedom, and he is made to say explicitly and disparagingly about Don Carlos, his heart is glowing with a newer virtue, that is newer than piety, a virtue that proud and certain and sufficient to itself will not be beggar to a faith. And then he reveals the identity of this monstrous new virtue in two fabulous words. He says, this virtue that will not be a beggar to a faith, he thinks. His head burns with a strange chimera. 'Tis mankind that he worships. In other words, the objection from the point of view of the church is that Don Carlos is concerned not with God but with man, not with heaven but with this world, and that of course is the true Enlightenment spirit. It's reason, nature, man, this life as against religion, against revelation, against faith. Now let us go to Act 5, Scene 10, the Grand Inquisitor's scene. After our analysis today, I urge you to reread it again at your leisure and see how stunningly complete it is as a scene. A total philosophy on every key issue, not stated as a speech, but dramatized in the context of a power struggle. The king trying to stand up to the Grand Inquisitor, the Grand Inquisitor asserting himself over the king and crushing him down to a position of abject obedience. A brilliantly logical scene in the course of which, not simply because he likes to talk, but as an absolute logical story necessity, the Grand Inquisitor has to come out against nature, reason, freedom, the individual, and he does it all righteously. Proudly on principle. He comes out against independence, against personal value judgment. He covers the waterfront from metaphysics to politics in a total integrated viewpoint. Now, this is the scene which I regard as unequaled in world theater for the combination of profundity and drama. By profundity, I mean the breadth and totality of the philosophy and its consistency. And by drama here, I mean the ability to integrate that profound and all-encompassing a philosophic view into moment-by-moment action on which the fate of the characters and the lives of the hero is going to depend. It is, on the face of it, an impossible assignment. And to be able to do it this way is really something that I think you'll never find except in the novels of Ayn Rand. And that's not theater, so I've got my word there within theatrical history. Let's just look at this scene a little bit so you get the idea of in what way it covers the waterfront philosophically and does so out of necessity of the logic of the structure. You see, that's what's so incredibly difficult to do. From the very opening, this scene takes off when the Grand Inquisitor comes on stage. He's 90. Deliberately, he's blind. Who does that remind you of? Tiresias, right? He's leaning on a cane. He's led by two young kids. But he has on his side a power much greater than eyesight. He has the power of philosophy. And just from the very opening, Philip is on the defensive. And the Grand Inquisitor comes in and says, "Do I stand before the king?" The king says, "You do." "I could no longer tell." Now, he says the double meaning. He's blind, or this is not the way a king behaves. I can't tell anymore, you see. Wonderful double meaning, which is one of the highest, greatest, most wonderful feats of dialogue if you can do it. Then we learn, I can't literally go over line by line, but just the high points. We learn that the Grand Inquisitor knew everything from the outset. And then he berates the king. "You knew about Poza's liberal leanings," liberal in the pro-freedom sense. "How could you be friendly with him?" And then the statement from the Grand Inquisitor, "If one finds mercy, why would we have the right to sacrifice 10,000? Which is what they're doing regularly at the Inquisition. So he is a man of principle, a true man of principle. He says, "How could you be friendly with the creature whom God, the Poza, whom God sent, quote, to make a show of ostentatious reason?" In other words, God sent him to show us that reason is mortal sin, so that we, the church, could punish him and teach mankind something about faith and duty. And the king says, "Well, forgive me, I'm an amateur at ruling." The Grand Inquisitor says, "You certainly are." And he says, "But do you really know so little about the minds of innovators and dreamers?" Now you notice the evils. Innovation and dreams as against obedience to the long-established decrees of the church. And the king says, "Well, I was looking to find a man." The instant comeback. "What then are men to you but numbers?" Nothing more. What does that mean? What is an individual? All that counts is the group, the collective. Now you see how it's all part of the same philosophy, and it comes in as a matter of necessity as he's knocking down the king. Only the collective counts. Men are nothing but numbers. King says, "Well, yes, I know, but I'm a little man. I'm not up to being a king." And the Grand Inquisitor says, "Don't try to deceive me." That's my paraphrase. "In courting Poza, you were trying to escape the rule of the church. You had a personal agenda. The Holy Order's chains weighed you down. You wanted to be free, unique. You wanted to carve out your own values in your own realm, and that is sin." King is silent. And the Grand Inquisitor turns the knife. He says, "Poza was killed, really, as a punishment for your sins by the church. Now I would like you to thank us for it. Kneel down before me. Lick my boots for having killed the man you love. Unconditional surrender." This is pretty powerful stuff. And then the king says, "Well, what about Don Carlos, my son? He plans to lead the rebels." The Grand Inquisitor says, well, what's the problem? Give him exactly what he deserves. The king is stunned at the idea, and he says, sarcastically, well, can you establish a new faith for me that will defend the murder of a child? And the Grand Inquisitor doesn't bat an eye. The Son of God died to make atonement to eternal justice. Why not your son? The king says, well, it's unnatural what you're asking. A father to kill his son, I would be offending the voice of nature. The Grand Inquisitor, no voice of nature is of any worth before our faith. So much for metaphysics. The king says, well, I don't know what to do. Who am I to know? You decide. Can I withdraw completely as a judge in this matter? The king says. Grand Inquisitor says, oh, yes, you can abdicate your power of judgment. Give it to me. And then the king says, well, he has a last pang, a last pull to his human status. And he says, well, he's my only son. For whom then have I gathered? I've got all this wealth and power. For whom? And then the climactic line of the Grand Inquisitor, better to destroy than to make free. Now, do you understand that line? This doesn't mean he's a nihilist. He is not a nihilist, the Grand Inquisitor. When he says better to destroy than to make free, he is talking about two different orientations. What is making free? What does that stand for in his mind? Oriented to yourself, your own desires, what was called the pursuit of happiness, as against being oriented to God, faith, obedience, on your knees. And Don Carlos has proved recalcitrant. So the choice is to let him be free, which means an affront to God, to virtue, and to the nature of reality, as the Grand Inquisitor has just demonstrated. Or else destroy him. And there's no other choice. Now, I hope you see just from this quick sample what a brilliant scene this is. Every word is necessitated by the action, by the ruling situation. There's no extraneous philosophizing. And yet all the bases of philosophy are covered, and an entire view of the world is dramatized. And it's dramatized in a passionate confrontation, not over theory, but over the life and death of a hero. Now, this is a feat, I say, that just simply can't be overestimated. It's pure intellectual and artistic genius on Schiller's part. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm content to just relish and admire that scene forever. There is just nothing higher that theater can offer than that scene. This is not the greatest play, but it certainly is, if not the greatest of all philosophic scenes, I can't think of what its competitor would be. Now, having given him that, do you feel why I chose this play, despite what you have to plow through? Now, as to content of the philosophy, as against the genius of his dramatization of it, I have to give a very different estimate. Because what is the philosophy Schiller wants the reader to come away with? Well, of course, we're to come away with the idea that the Grand Inquisitor is wrong about reason. He's wrong about nature. He's wrong about the individual. He's wrong about freedom. There's only one point that he's right about, which? Sacrifice. The need of serving something beyond yourself. Now, if you're objectivist, you know the tragic self-contradiction of Schiller. Because his trinity is reason, sacrifice, freedom. And yet, as you know from Ayn Rand's writings, sacrifice makes freedom impossible, and it makes reason impossible. And more than that, Schiller demonstrates both those points in his play himself, as we've just seen. He himself gives you the data to conclude that by enshrining sacrifice, he's laying the basis to destroy both reason and freedom. And that the end result is that the Grand Inquisitor mentality is going to win out the world, as in fact he has. Now, the primary villain here, needless to say, is not Schiller. I quote, "Schiller's debt to Kant is a commonplace of intellectual history." Unquote. Even though Kant's critique wasn't published until a few years after Don Carlos, Schiller studied Kant's views in his university very early, because he was right near Kant, even before Kant was widely published and known. Schiller was, in effect, the first Kantian in history, or one of the very first of Kant's disciples. Intellectually, Don Carlos is a perfect statement of what you get when you merge the best of the Enlightenment spirit with the purest of Kantianism. Now, you just would say there could be no such merger, and yet this play is just what this play is. And what you get when you merge them, although Schiller never knew it, is the total triumph of the irrational. Now, we're going to have to, if we're going to have some questions, stop at this point with Don Carlos. I just want to say in conclusion that despite the corruption of the ideas and the flaws in the play's construction, I hope you were able to enjoy the unprecedented values that this play offers. Even more simply, I hope you were as thrilled by the last act of this play as I am. I know it was a lot of work, but I want to thank you for reading it and giving me a very enjoyable opportunity to discuss it. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, I have several questions here. I'm not encouraging or even accepting written questions, but every once in a while, someone, when I'm not looking, because I can't, because if I did, I'd have hundreds and hundreds of questions and no time to sort through. But every once in a while, someone just drops a question and I read it, and sometimes they're good. So I've got a few here that I want to comment on, but I'll start. John, did you want to? We'll go a little over 12:15, obviously.
Yeah, I'm just dying for you to elaborate on the notion of romance within the relationship between men.
You want me to elaborate on the notion of romance between men? I just happen to have a note here. Actually, it's in the context of a written question, so I think you can sit down because I'll be at least 5 minutes here. Someone submitted a written question about sexual attraction. And the question is it possible for sexual attraction to have a non-volitional cause? And this was in conjunction, I think, with the theory that genes explain homosexuality. So we have a number of questions here about sex and gays and males and this is pretty much outside the province of philosophy, but I don't mind dogmatizing briefly. Let's cover this whole thing, and I'll put your question, John, in among it. To begin with this question as it was worded, is it possible for sexual attraction to have a non-volitional cause? No. Sexual attraction is a form of desire, which is a form of emotion. And all emotion, according to objectivism, is volitional in the sense that it goes back to intellectual content, conclusions and value judgments, explicit or implicit, that are ultimately chosen by the volitional operation of the consciousness. It's commitment to think or not to think. That will lead to certain conclusions, and that will automatically lead to certain emotions, certain desires, including certain kinds of sexual desires. So in this sense, all of the content of a conceptual consciousness, all of its feelings go back to its volitional operation. And therefore, it's all volitional. This does not, however, mean that you choose a given desire on a given day. It's not as though, you know, a volitional consciousness means Tuesday morning you wake up and say, I want men. Or, I decided I like philosophy. Or, I like picking flowers. You don't just decide likes out of the blue. And therefore, people who testify that they've looked back and they simply don't remember any moment when they didn't have a certain feeling, they certainly didn't sit down and say, today is my choice. That doesn't mean anything. Desires flow from the logic of your total premises, conscious or subconscious. And to you, the person, certain desires going all the way down into the earliest childhood conclusions may be inexplicable, and they may be stubborn. You may not want that desire, and you have no idea where it comes from or how to change it. And it may take years of therapy to unearth the premises on which it depends. Now, all of this applies to sexual desire as well. You know, far be it for me to go into what would cause one orientation or another, but one theory of homosexual desire that makes some sense to me. This is not objectivism, because objectivism does not have a theory of sexual etiology. This is, I'm just dogmatizing because you asked me, would be that if a child, for whatever reason, good or bad, reaches a state of diminished self-esteem under certain circumstances, that can affect his feeling of self-esteem in his sexual role as a man or as a woman. And under certain circumstances, he may be led to look for validation of his identity from another member of his sex. And that would lead to, it's kind of like a psychological need from not having developed properly. By the way, it's certainly not directly volitional. I don't even think that developing homosexual desire has necessarily got any immorality involved. Now, in some cases, it obviously does, but then there's a hell of a lot of heterosexuals who are immoral, too. So there's no correlation between morality and sexual orientation. I definitely believe that an individual can be pure, honest, but be in a situation where because of upbringing, environment, and confusion on his part, he absorbs certain self-doubting conclusions, including self-doubt about his role as a man or woman. And that leads him to a homosexual desire, which is absolutely outside of any choice in the sense of any moral evasion or dishonesty. It's still choice in the sense that he runs his consciousness. But we can't hold him culpable if he makes honest errors. And particularly today, where there's not much psychotherapy to be able to cure such a person. Now that takes me to the question of, do I think genes, now we're way off of Schiller here, but I promised the person, do I think genes could be responsible for homosexuality? No, I definitely do not. Genes can affect only physical endowments. Now, I can conceive, I don't say there's a basis for this, but I can conceive a gene for alcoholism, because I could conceive that you would inherit the kind of system which is highly susceptible to alcohol, because that's a physical ingestion of a substance. I could conceive a gene or a genetic constellation for schizophrenia, because I could take that back conceivably to some weakness in the structure or function of the brain or some component thereof. But I could not conceive a gene which determines the object of sexual desire, because that is entirely a matter of what you perceive and how you respond to it. It has nothing to do with your physical structure or constitution. It would be just as much sense as a gene for loving long-haired people or blue-eyed people. You just can't have a gene for a preference. Conceivably, there's a gene that makes you highly sexed, or, you know, a gene that makes you lower sexed, you're content with once a month instead of every other day. But I can't even dream of the mechanism by which a gene would affect the content of your evaluation. So I do believe that all sexual orientations are chosen, but not in the simple-minded way of you just sit down and make a choice. And now we get to John Ridpath's question. We get to that because that's what I wrote down next, about male love. What would Ayn Rand have to say about that? Ayn Rand defined love in Private Conversation, romantic love, as the status of one individual to another when that individual is irreplaceable in the person's life. And love, in the romantic sense for her, was a profound passion that was not necessarily sexual, but was of a completely different order than friendship. Friendship, even a very intense friendship, she believed, was peripheral to the essence of your soul. Conceivably, you would feel grief if you lost your friend. You would feel loss, etc., etc. But a loved one is someone that is literally irreplaceable. It leaves a hole in your life that nothing else can fill. Even if you meet the perfect embodiment of virtue and become tremendous friends, the uniqueness of that individual and their place in your life, nothing can equal. And she felt that this was a very profound need of man, to have a relationship that had that deeper commitment. She did not see it as a continuum of a casual acquaintance, a nice guy, nice to go out with, a good friend. Gee, I really like him. A lot of admiration. He's really, you know, a big thing. And then I love him. There was a line, and then there was a chasm. And when you went from all of that to I love him, that was a metaphysical statement. Now, she did not see any reason why one man could not feel this for another, or for that matter, one woman for another. This degree of profound significance that is irreplaceable in your life. Now, particularly among two men, Ayn Rand, as you know, was not a great admirer of women. And I asked her once when I was a very naive kid, and I didn't know anything, including even tact. And I said to her, you're such a man worshiper in your writings and in your statements. If you had a choice, would you have wanted to be born a man? And you know what she said to me? Involuntarily. Oh, no, then I'd have to love a woman. No, excuse me. It was the other way around. She said, that's right. No, that's I got it out right. No, I'd have to love a woman. And the idea for her as a woman and as a man worshiper, having her love object as a woman was just too awful to be contemplated. Now, therefore, she had great sympathy for the idea of man as the hero and another man seeing that, particularly in a case like Wynand and Rourke, where they're equals. And yet at the same time, Rourke has an edge of strength. And Wynand sees that this is what he could have become. It was a setup for two such passionate valuers, one to apply to the other. And she told me she even had Rourke nude, naked, in front of Wynand when he came out of the water on the yacht. And Wynand says to him, it should have been a statue of you. That's the closest you got to hinting, not that there was a sexual relation, but that Winant was in love with this man so profoundly that he even had a special aesthetic pleasure from looking at his body. Now, the obvious question someone's going, this has nothing to do with Schiller now. So I'm going to go on after 12:15. You can leave if you want. But the obvious question now is, well, if they're that far along, by the way, Joan Crawford, according to Miss Rand, once asked her at a dinner party on that very basis, did she intend, because Joan Crawford thought the answer was yes, to depict a homosexual relationship between Winant and Rourke. And Miss Rand said indignantly, no, she did not. But this was widely picked up in Hollywood at the time. Now, why not? If they're willing to go this far, why not just come out, assuming that they're both valuers and both heroes and so on, for a directly sexual relationship? Now, here again, I'm going completely outside of philosophy. I do not think that philosophy as such has anything to say about sexual orientation. I will just tell you as a dogma, and don't come up ask me to explain it. It's up to Dr. Packer and her field to explain this. It's not a mystery, but it's not philosophy. The answer, in a word, is that a sexual relationship does not merely involve genital stimulation. If that's all it involved, any two entities that had that capacity would be an appropriate pair. Essential to a sexual relation is what you can call conquest and surrender, or dominance and submission. And Ayn Rand held, at least, that if this is not to be just arbitrary role playing, it has to have an anatomical basis. There has to be a reason in the nature of the two bodies why one conquers and one surrenders. Otherwise, she thought it was arbitrary and demeaning and irrational. That's for that reason that she believed that homosexuality was improper. Not immoral, because she certainly recognized and stated that you could be completely moral and just trapped in an upbringing and conclusions that you didn't understand, but objectively wrong in that, knowingly or not, it is a defiance of one of the conditions of a mature and healthy sexual relationship. But that is not the same thing, you see, as this irreplaceable male love relationship. Now, if you don't get all that, you still can get Don Carlos, so I'm going on. That is the first and last I'm going to say about sex in this course. Now, let me take one more written question to plunge us directly back into Don Carlos. Why do you not include the Grand Inquisitor in your statement of the plot theme? Terrific question. You see why that's a good question? Because he's such a terrific character. And my answer to that is, that's Schiller's problem, not mine. In other words, the Grand Inquisitor was not integral to the story as told by Schiller. The whole story would hold even if there was no Grand Inquisitor scene. It's not a story about the king's relation to the church. It's not a story about Poe's fight against the church. Now, of course, the Grand Inquisitor scene is logical. It's causally related. It's certainly not an arbitrary addendum. But to be part of the plot theme, it has to be unescapable and inevitable in the core of the action. And this is not. It's in the nature of a brilliant afterthought. When he was really steamed up and going, But he did not have the church or the Grand Inquisitor or anything representing him as a major element. Domingo was just, who was the only carrier of religion through the play, was just like Alba representing the nobles. He wasn't a major figure. Now I'll give you this analogy. If you were giving a plot theme for Atlas Shrugged, you would certainly include Galt, even though he doesn't appear till the end. But that's because there's a hell of a lot in the actual novel where Galt appears. But just imagine, for instance, that there was no hint in the novel. There was no unknown inventor. There was nobody asking who is John Galt. There was no Dagny looking out and wondering where is the ideal man at the end of the tracks, etc. All of that was gone. The story went on. And suddenly, out of the blue, she opens the door and there's John Galt. You say, who the hell is that? And even if he's a great character, you'd have to say, well, this wasn't part of the story. It wasn't an ongoing thing. It was an afterthought. It wasn't integrated into the total. It would be more like, suppose it's one of these James Bond movies, and at the very end, you're fighting Dr. No all the way through, and at the very end, it turns out that he's financed by General Motors. I mean, all that does is put in an anti-business swipe then, but it doesn't do anything for the story. And that's the way the Grand Inquisitor is. It is of tremendous thematic significance, but it is not a plot necessity. Now, ideally, your plot and your theme should be integrated. The theme should necessitate the plot and vice versa. But here is a failure of integration on Schiller's part, specifically the failure of flaw of not integrating a fabulous character who is crucial to the clarity of the theme into the structure of the plot theme. And the reason that he didn't is not that he couldn't, but that he got the idea too late after he was already on another play. So, in a sense, he outgrew the play and became too brilliant too soon for this play. So I think aesthetically it's a flaw, but I'm certainly prepared to live with the flaw of that dimension. All right, I'll take a few more questions from the floor, if anybody has any. Otherwise, yes.
This is difficult to ask this question. I'm trying to formulate it properly. But given the state of professional philosophy during the 18th century, do you believe it was actually possible for the non-philosopher, the statesman, the artist, you know, the serious thinker who was not a professional philosopher, to really identify the contradiction in between altruism and the notion of freedom and benevolence and reason? Since altruism was always taught at that time as being necessary to any universal view
of
man.
Well, I would answer you this way. You don't have to be a professional. Professional means you make your living, you know, at this field. And Kant is sometimes regarded as the first professional philosopher because he was an actual professor who gained his livelihood this way. You certainly do not have to be a professional philosopher to challenge the tradition of the ages that ties altruism in with all good things. But you do, I'll concede you this, have to be a philosopher. An ordinary artist, however sensitive, or businessman, or what were the other categories you mentioned, statesman, etc., who was not a philosopher with an original philosophic mind, would never think to challenge that combination. Even Jefferson didn't think to challenge it, because that means you have to go to the very, very roots of the West. You have to go all the way to Christianity and Judaism versus paganism, who didn't have a whole code of ethics either, and reconceive from scratch. And that requires a philosopher. Now, the thing is, Schiller was a philosopher, but he was not an epical philosopher. You would need for that a philosopher that could shape a whole epic, that could challenge down to the base. And there is no predicting when that's going to come. That is not a product of social circumstances. It could have happened at that time, but it didn't. It could have happened in our time, and it did. Unfortunately, we would have been saved, or fortunately, we would have been saved a tremendous amount if, that kind of challenge had been raised right at this time, at the time of the American and French Revolution, and before Kant was institutionalized. I mean, you would have had utopia. There would have been a battle, but at least there would have been somebody battling. Unfortunately, that never did take place, and then Kant became entrenched thereafter. So I'm not blaming Schiller. No, you can never blame a man for not being an epical genius. I mean, that's just ridiculous. It's like blaming a man, for not being able to serve faster than Bjorn Borg. You just can't do it. You can't do more than you can do. But it is true that without that, in this situation, you were lost. Yes, sir. Oh, on the back?
Yeah. I believe you said that double meanings, you referred to them as the highest feat of dialogue, if you can do it. Would you talk about the value of double meanings, please?
Well, the value of double meaning is really very simple. You get two for the price of one. What is terrific on stage is to have a character say something where you, the audience, know more about it than the other character he's addressing. So you have the tremendous joy of watching the one meaning, and at the same time, you get the deeper level. Or maybe the other character gets the deeper level, but he's not allowed to acknowledge it. And so you have a much richer and fuller presentation. The whole thing with art is, let us put it this way, the whole thing with art is integration. I've covered that in my book. And integration involves tremendous condensation. You want one element to carry as much as possible. Every element has to carry the plot, the characterization, the theme, you see. Within that, therefore, the more dense a word, now by dense I don't mean opaque or inaccessible or non-objective, but the denser, the more it's able to carry, the more eloquent, the more power, because art is the opposite of something diffuse. You don't want a whole bunch of things strung out. You want a few images, even in a play, that will condense and give you a visual reality. And a double meaning is one, only one out of many, but one brilliant technique within the theater of doing this, because it conveys a deeper form of the reality in a condensed, economical fashion. That's one of the hallmarks of Miss Rand, the ability to use dialogue or gesture with double meanings. And I gave the example in my book on objectivism of wine and standing up, and all the mean at the trial of Rourke, and all the meanings that carried. That is the same as the issue of the double meaning. And you know who else in this course is excellent at double meanings? Is Medley. If you reread near the end of Mona Vana, there's a whole passage there where Mona Vana is making a speech to the king, which he understands in one way, and we understand that she has an entirely different meaning. She's supposedly denouncing Prince Ivali to the king, and in fact she's denouncing the king to his face. She's denouncing her husband to his face, Marco. And he doesn't get it. So you have this tremendous tension and interplay. It's extremely elegant. Now you're pushing me there to give you a theory of stylistic considerations. I don't have a theory of style yet. If I did, I would certainly lecture on that. Now, I just want to say it's 12:27, so I don't have even the shadow of an excuse to stay here this late, but I'm going to stay for another couple minutes, but you're all, there's no hard feelings if you want to just get up and leave for lunch. Yes.
Speaking of double meanings, the line from Othello, put out the light and put out the light.
Yes.
I seem to have a different interpretation of that than you had. Mine was basically the murder of Desdemona, and prior to that, putting out the light of her eyes. You had interpreted...
You mean put out the light of her eyes and then put out the light of her life.
She was killed with a pillow.
Well, I guess you could take it that way, but it's traditionally... You see, he's holding a candle, which he snuffs before he kills her. So I think the traditional interpretation is truer to the action is also... What's good about the traditional interpretation of that line is that it's the percept. Art has to be perceptual. And so you see him put out the light, and that becomes the symbol for putting out the light. And it's not so much the light, as I interpret it, of her life, as of his own life. He's snuffing out all light in the act of snuffing, all value in the act of snuffing out the candle. Yes. I have to be a little abrupt here because I only have 1 minute. Yes.
Can you describe your preparation for this entire course, both in terms of the tasks and the time involved? I'd just be interested to know what went into it.
Well, that's certainly the last question. Okay. I started preparing for this course in September, and I did one play a month. I work, or list last year, for a complexity of reasons, I was able to work only 2 days a week. So that's approximately 6 to 8 hours a day. And I did each play, including the lecture, in about 8 or 9 days of full-time work. And that included, first of all, picking the playwright, which I had pretty much picked, because you have no choice. If you're going to take great playwrights, they just name themselves. The harder task was picking which play, and I had to skim, you know, the leading candidates and make a decision on what play. Then I had to read the play and try to figure out, you know, if it wasn't one that I already knew well, and some of them weren't, make notes on what it means. Then I had to, simultaneously, scan 3 or 4 other translations to try to find one that was easier to understand, more accessible. And then I buried myself in secondary literature. You know, go to the library and just get 6 or 8 books out of the stacks and just swallow it in, you know, everything you can think of. Then your head is bulging. Now, all the way through this, that's about 3 or 4 days of full-time work so far. But, you know, across several weeks, so you've got lots of time to think. And the idea is always, what is this play about? Not the theme, but the action. I was always from the beginning trying to work out, what is the plot theme? And I'd be constantly writing notes that I tried to indicate to you. And across several weeks, the plot theme would fall into line. Now, once that fell into line, it was a breeze. Because then, you know, I make notes in the margins, and I just collect my notes. And I put all the notes, you know, with scissors and paste under characterization, one big pile, and under plot, one big pile, and under theme, one big pile. And then I just sit down at the typewriter and sort through them for an order and type it all out. And that was basically how I did it. So I would say of the time involved, there's maybe 60 to 70 hours per play total, counting the writing of the lecture. And of that, about one half was immersing myself in alternate texts and research to figure out the plot theme. And then one half was figuring out and batting out the rest. Does that answer you? Does that help you? Okay, have a nice weekend. Oh, wait. Okay, you can turn the tape off now. Thank you very much.